The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is the seventh and final day of this first session here at Mountain Gate in 2018. We're in January, but we may as well be in, April. 40 degrees today, trying very hard to precipitate, not very successful at it. We're supposedly having a storm, but it's not got much punch to it. It's a very, very strange period of weather. Very dry, which leads to some concern in the valley because we do need to have snow so that the acequias, the traditional irrigation ditches, can run so that people can irrigate their fields and grow hay for their animals. It's a traditional way of life up here, and it continues, and it's important. We'll continue today with sharing some of the words of Kathleen Dowling Singh in her last book, Unbinding. It's really interesting that she wrote that book, completed that book just before she died. It's newly issued. She died last year, not so long ago, since this is only January. And she had clearly been working on herself for a very, very long time. She was a transpersonal psychologist and did a lot of hospice work. And her first book, as a matter of fact, was called The Grace in Dying. And it told the stories of any number of people who, in their last days or hours, went from being extremely caught in greed, anger, and delusion to somehow seeing something deeper and turning around in those last days or weeks or hours. And that gives hope. So many people die terrified of dying. How many are able to simply let go? This is what we actually work at every moment in our Zen practice, not in terms of necessarily letting go the end of life as we know it, but letting go our attachment to everything so that when the end of life does come, it will be seamless and easily done. Many, many years ago, I read a book that has not been in print for decades. It was called The Wheel of Death. It was the second book of Kapila-rishi, and it was a very small book, four chapters only, death, dying, karma, and rebirth. And in the chapter on dying, it was amazing to read of Socrates, for one, and many Buddhist monks who simply approached dying with ease, without any fear, with actually curiosity in the case of Socrates, who told his wailing students that, why are you crying? For all you know, death is not at all like you think it is. It may be one of the freest experiences you've ever had. And it sort of mimics the Buddha also when he was dying. And his disciples were also wailing around him. And he also said, you don't understand. What is it we don't understand? And how can we learn to understand? Yesterday we talked about the importance of attention and awareness and curiosity. And that continues today as well. The first quote that I will share with you is this one. The illusion of self only holds a grip on us when we're not paying attention to what's actually going on. And it's the illusion of self that is the source of our problems. It's the source of our pain and suffering. And it's false. It's an illusion. And we assume it's permanent, fixed, and that's who we really are, which can't be farther from the truth. The illusion of self only holds a grip on us when we're not paying attention to what's going on. And this is why attention and awareness is so vital in practice. This is why this Susokan practice, this extended breath practice, is so incredibly potent, because it, if it's done properly, extending the out-breath, the body relaxed, the awareness coming from the hara, it requires us to pay attention to the experience of breathing out. And as part of that, to let go alternative interests. We can't really keep the yada yada going if we're doing that practice properly. And that's vital to its success and its effectiveness. This is serious paying attention. And when we pay close attention, we begin to see the holes in our structured assumption of a permanent self. Nisargadatta, who was an Indian spiritual master, you can see videos of him, YouTube videos of him on the web, and he apparently said, in order to become free, you had to step out of the web, and it's easy. The web is full of holes. And when we do this serious paying attention in everything we do, it should be 24/7. On the cushion, we're working with the Susokan to hone our ability to pay attention and not get distracted by the yada yada, by this ongoing self-created illusory sense of self. Again, I quote Descartes, who said, "I think, therefore I am." And we keep this background thoughting, Kepler, where she used to call it, because it's not really thinking. Thinking has a role. It's not as huge a role as we assume it is, but it has a role. Communication, which comes out of thinking. But thoughting is this constant flow of chaotic fragments of thoughts, fragments of music, fragments of conversations that we keep going in the background, in as if it weren't happening, we disappear. And actually that's true. Who we think we are would disappear. My former mother-in-law, who lived alone in a three-bedroom house, I don't know how she died, because by that time I was not a part of the family, but I don't think it was a very easy death, given how she was when she was still alive, when I knew her. But she had a television set in her bedroom. She had a television set in the kitchen, which it was an open plan room there. So there was just a counter between the kitchen and the rest of the dining and living area. And she also had a television in the living room, which she could see from the kitchen. And every morning she would get up and flip on the television in the bedroom, get herself dressed, leave it going, and walk into the kitchen, turn on that one, get herself the coffee, and go into the living room, turn that one on. So she had three television sets blaring away all day long, as if she was afraid of the silence. And that's what does happen to us when we initially find a hole in the constant thread of thoughting, the silence, can become unsettling. If I'm not thinking, if I don't have that background noise going, am I going to disappear? And fear can set in. But our practice involves facing fear a lot. And as we face it more and more consistently, we begin to discover it doesn't have the bite we thought it did when we were trying to avoid it. So if fear comes up in the course of your practice, tune into the physical experience of that fear. What is the energy of fear in your body? Tune in. Stay present. Stay aware. Pay attention. And as you do this again and again, it ceases, as I said, to be a problem. Let's continue with some more of her writing. She has been talking about the chain of causation, is sometimes called the dependent origination or dependent arising, which is the sort of elaboration of how we are caught in this pain and suffering that we self-create. And I don't mean self-create in the sense of anything but an illusory self. Because we have this idea that we're somebody, and that somebody constantly has to be reinforced, defended, that somebody gets angry, that somebody gets sad, that somebody gets irritated when somebody does something we don't like. And it's full of likes and dislikes and opinions and judgments. And yet it's a false, totally false, conjuring up of our being. So, how to let it go? Again, she says, the illusion of self only holds a grip on us when we're not paying attention to what's going on. Paying attention with this wordless curiosity, this raising an eyebrow, is what I'm feeling really accurate? Are my assumptions really right on? Or are they skewed by some experiences I've had? What's the real truth here? This is what we're searching for. The fundamental truth of our being. The illusions of hoping for satisfaction, imagining we can permanently secure happiness, and believing that ego is who we are can be dissipated as mist dissipates in sunlight. What's revealed, in Catholic mystic Martin Laird's beautiful words, is their sunlit absence. When we begin to see the holes in our fabrication of a self, suddenly we can experience moments of true peace, true awareness, true freedom from who we think we are. And that true freedom involves not being driven to react as a result of the self-image. The wheel of suffering, which is one way of depicting the dependent origination. The wheel of suffering, creating the I illusion, revolves around a belief in ego as the owner, the agent, the victim, and the only relevant referent. It is blind to the fact that ego is a byproduct of the circulating conditions that create it. And the fundamental condition is ignorance, and that's ignorance of the true nature of reality. Ignorance and craving. We are not enough aware of the truth of existence, and so we blindly go about assuming that this this ego I is the permanent fixture, and that we deserve happiness, and it should always be ours, and it goes on from there. And we crave, when we cite the Bodhisattva vows, we speak of ending craving. Ignorance is vital for the ending of craving. When we begin to see little bits of the truth, and this extended out breath is incredibly powerful for that. And again, it has to do with attention, awareness, and curiosity. And with not staying at a psychological level, but at going beneath words. In that sense, whatever has happened to us in our life is not so relevant. We're searching beyond all of that experience, all of those assumptions, all of that history, to what truly is. Because it's what truly is. Recognizing that, opening to that, that will liberate us. When we see with depth that there isn't anybody that needs to be defended, the freedom is incalculable. And we have the experience of Shirobu Nan, who was the middle-aged monk in a tiny little village in Japan, when one of the young women in the village got pregnant. She wasn't married, and so that was a rather intense experience for the entire village, really, and particularly for her and her family. And they tried to get her to identify the father, and she refused. And finally, she just burst out, is that monk, Shirobu Nan, whose name, by the way, literally translates, the great way is not difficult. There's a chant, affirming faith in mind, or it was written by the third Chinese ancestor, and it goes, the great way is not difficult, that means the way we are practicing now. For those who do not pick and choose, it doesn't mean that we don't make decisions about things. It means that we're not constantly judging. At any rate, he was accused. And when the baby was born, as you already have heard many times this story because it's so amazing, the baby was brought to him by the very angry, terribly embarrassed grandparents. And they held this baby out and said, here, you did this. You caused a great deal of disaster and anguish in this family and in this village. Now, take the responsibility and raise this child. And he did. And it was not that easy. As a middle-aged monk, he didn't really have any experience with raising infants. And no Dr. Spock was around to is that who it was? Anyway, the famous pediatrician in the 1950s and 60s was not around to help guide people who were not accustomed to raising children. And of course, the mother's access to the child was limited, no doubt simply to feeding the child. And under the eagle eyes of her parents. When this encounter took place, Shirobu Nan, who could see clearly and was deeply enlightened, he was the grandfather of Hakuin, the grandfather of Zen of Hakuin, not his physical grandfather, but his Dharma grandfather. And he could see that you know, the girl says he's the father. There's no arguing with that one. And so he accepted the child humbly and did not try to defend himself, just stood upright and accepted this child. This is the factors that appear to be in place at the moment. And so he realized that the appropriate thing to do was to raise this child. And he only responded when the grandparents brought the baby by saying, "Oh, I see it. It appears like this, does it?" And raised the child for a year. And after a year, the mother confessed who the father really was. And so the grandparents came back, and now they're really, really, really embarrassed, both because they've accused this man when he wasn't to blame, and heads bowed down, they came and requested the baby back. And again, he just said, "Oh, I see, it does appear like this, doesn't it?" And the incredible freedom that he had, not to have to defend himself, not because he had low self-image, but because he was totally free. This is available to each one of us. If we pay enough attention, if we are curious enough, long enough, we'll begin to see holes in that net, that fabrication of self. Ignorance will begin to be replaced by opening, understanding, awareness. And when that happens, the rest of the chain of causation, as it's called, will simply crumble. Our own insight into the first noble truth, a recognition that the separate sense of self and a pervasive sense of unease inevitably arise together, is the start of this awakening. How long we have to work at seeing through ignorance, at seeing through this false sense of self, depends on how strongly we are attached to it, and also how sincerely and how committed we are to becoming free of it. Craving is pretty powerful. At its worst, it brings forth addiction. But we can overcome it through insight, which comes through attention and curiosity. And again, there's an old Buddhist teaching story about a monk who walks into a room and sees a snake. Instantly, he's filled with fear and an intense aversion. Upon investigation, though, this snake, quote unquote, is revealed to simply be a coiled rope. In that moment of seeing, the snake, the fear, and the aversion are instantly dispelled. The illusion is unmasked. This is the power of inquiry and insight. When we shine a light, the darkness instantly disappears. Every single extended out-breath, every single time we choose to go there and not into a daydream about some future event or some past event, that light begins to grow. There's another story, a Japanese story about a man who has a good friend who's an archer, and he goes to have tea with his archer friend, and he's seated in a place of honor and offered a cup of tea, and to his horror, in this cup of tea sees a tiny snake. But being polite, he doesn't say a word about it. He just drinks the tea and goes home and gets sick. And he's sick for a while. And eventually he comes back, and his friend again seats him in the same seat of honor in his room, again offers him a cup of tea. And it, this time he says, "There's a snake in my tea. Why are you doing this to me?" And the friend points to the ceiling, and there's a bowl hanging just above the seat. And the reflection of the bowl in the cup of tea appears to be a snake. This is what the illusion of a self-image can do to us. It creates a reality that is not true, it's not real. And yet we take it to be absolutely real. And we suffer as a result of it, and it drives our behavior. Instead of responding to situations, we react to them out of the mistaken assumption that we're this person that we think we are. A.H. Almas, the mystic teacher of the Diamond Approach, points out to us that, quote, to contact the deeper truth of who we are, we must engage in some activity or practice that questions what we assume to be true. And so, as we're doing the out-breath, this is not a physical exercise. This is not something like practicing the piano. It's a tool. It's a vehicle to opening to the truth. And as such, we need to have a level of commitment to doing it that will bring about results. And that commitment to doing it must necessarily include not just the focus and the extension of the out-breath, but the curiosity, the openness to possibility that rides that out-breath. It's an incredibly powerful tool. The session has gone very well. There's been a certain amount of letting go that's quite inspiring. There's been a dedication to the practice. The important thing is to keep it going. Persistence is what makes enlightenment come about. Persistence using the right tools. This curiosity, the attention and awareness, the commitment to giving it everything we have, even when it seems totally discouraging, even when it seems useless, even when it seems that we're not making any progress at all, to keep on going in faith that it will bring results. We do that and it will. And Shirovanan is an incredible example of this. It's impossible to describe his mind state, the degree to which he was totally let go. This is our natural state of mind. This self-image is an artificial construct that takes us away from realizing that and brings us suffering, momentary happiness, more suffering, perhaps a little more momentary happiness, challenges in our life because we react and we cause more karmic burdens on ourselves. To become free of that is incredible. And everyone has the potential to do it if we are willing to commit to the practice for the long haul. however long it takes. It does not matter how long it takes. It's really a process that, to be totally free as the Buddha was, it can take lifetimes. And it will, whatever we do in this lifetime, will carry through to the next one if we are persistent and committed to it. I think that's enough now. We just have a few hours left in Sesshin. Our level of power is tremendous because of all this work everyone has been doing through these almost 7 days. To continue that, because the potential is so much greater right now than it was even yesterday, even this morning, and certainly even more than at the beginning of Sesshin, because of all the work that's gone on so far in Sesshin. Take advantage of that. Dive deep. Dare to let go your hold on the cliff. What awaits is liberation. Don't mind the fear. It's just a figment of your imagination, as this self-image also is. So I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.